Chapter 16. Make straight in the desert a highway. An old man stands weeping in an olive grove, his arms clasping as far around the gnarled trunk of a tree as he can reach. His wife is waiting for him at the house, a big bundle of things ready to put on her head and carry away as soon as her husband makes up his mind to come. How is he to tear himself from the trees which have been his life? But he will have to. He has been warned that his village is to be blown up in an hour. It is unfortunate, the Israelis have told him, but terrorists have been sheltered there and there is nothing to do but blow them up. All the houses, everything must go. The war, of course, has been over for months, but there are still problems along the borders. He puts his cheek against the knobbed bark. This tree, too, will go with the house, or if it doesn't, it will die a slow, lonely death. For who would love it as the old man has loved it? His wife calls again, and he goes. They join the rest of the villagers, refugees now, they know, for they will not be allowed to return to their land. Their vineyards and olive groves, if spared, will not be theirs any longer. And what else can Israel do? I promise you, a serious, reflective Jew said to me, we will crush them. Either the Arabs will live with us on our terms, or we crush them. And a gray-haired Arab schoolteacher said to me, the day must come when we will slaughter every Jew. I have had many Jewish students. I have never made any distinction between Arab and Jew in my school, but I know now that we simply cannot tolerate them. We must drive them into the sea or slaughter them, or they will drive us into the desert. One of the less palatable facts of life is the inexorable principle that one man's victory is another's defeat, one man's joy, another's sorrow. The triumph of the State of Israel in 1967 meant utter devastation for hundreds of thousands of Arabs. What Israel gained in the famous 6 days has been gradually, imperceptibly to the outside world, augmented since. Because of the activities of Al-Fatah, the Arab terrorist organization, Israel found it necessary to level village after village along the borders. We count the cost of war in terms of lives lost, and we try to think their deaths glorious, who thus are expended, if they are on our side. As for all the leftover expenses, disabled veterans, ruined cities, warped children's lives, and refugees, we try to do something about them officially, but personally, we much prefer to forget them whenever possible. The story of the million Arab refugees left over from the 1948 war was too old to think much about. Were they not simply stewing in their own hatred, refusing to be repatriated or relocated? Was their plight not the responsibility of the Arab nations, after all? Why did Arab leaders not take it upon themselves to relieve these suffering multitudes instead of ignoring them completely and concentrating on their own gains in power and prestige? Pawns, the refugees have been called, held as tools in a power struggle and exhibited to the world as proofs by both sides that the other is to blame. I was told many times by Jews not to forget that the refugees had left their homes voluntarily. No one drove them out. In fact, they were begged to stay. But the Arabs told me that in their sections of Western Jerusalem during the 1948 war, sound trucks warned the inhabitants that they had just a few hours to escape if they did not want to meet the same fate as the villagers of Deir Yassin, an Arab town on the border between Israel and Palestine, who were massacred and thrown into a well. Most of the Arabs did not dare to ignore the warning and left. One woman told me, my father said, I'm not leaving. Over my dead body, they will take my house. But you must leave, the Jews. But you must leave, the Jews told him. That night, a shot narrowly missed him, and the next day he went to his friends, Jewish professors, and asked them what he should do. We cannot protect you any longer, they told him. We spent one more night in our house, filled with terror. I remember the dogs howling in the streets that night. They howled like wild beasts. And the next day, we packed up what we could take and went to another zone. We were given a paper which said that our property had been sold. The custodian of, quote, absentee property sold it to Jews who live in it to this day. During the war of 1967, the same device was used, they said, in the areas of Bethlehem and Beit Jala. Sound trucks moved through the streets announcing that if people did not evacuate, Israel would not take responsibility for the consequences. A nun came out of the hospital and asked the men in the truck, "Where am I to flee? I have 200 people in bed in this building." "Well, stay inside and shut all the windows," was the suggestion offered. No refugee is so by choice. Remember that. No refugee is so by choice, said a man who helps to distribute relief to the refugees in the Jerusalem area. They have never faced an enemy. They were driven out at night. Their homes were dynamited. The Israelis thought that by frightening one village, they could set an example for all. You've heard about Deir Yassin. So you see that it was never a clean war. One village after another went up in the air. That is what caused the exodus. How could mothers with children sit at home and wait for it to happen? Perhaps the Israelis made more noise than actual harm, but it was a campaign of terror. Let no one say the refugees chose to leave. End quote. Buses waited at the Damascus Gate during the 1967 war to take those who wished to go across the Jordan River. Since the Arabs clearly had decided to leave, the Israelis stood ready to help them get out. Out of their own hair, of course, for the fewer Arabs left in the newly conquered territories, the better for the Israelis. Quote, "Those of them who you let remain shall be as pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall trouble you in the land where you dwell," God had said to Moses at Jericho long ago. This was probably not the sole motive, nor perhaps even any part of the motive of some. There must have been Israelis moved by kindness alone, who saw only the weeping women with their huge bundles and their clinging children. How could they let them walk those endless dusty miles? One busload of refugees was stopped in the desert. Surely they're going to be shot now, thought some. But when they got out of the bus, they were led to a tank truck filled with water and given cups. The Arabs were incredulous. What sort of conquerors were these? Cold water in the desert and smiling young soldiers to help them get it? But there were also cameramen, television crews, news photographers, grinding and snapping away. Were they recording the news or arranging it? The Arabs were fairly sure they knew. On a morning of pouring rain, I accompanied the representative of a Christian mission when he went to inspect a makeshift school and clinic near a village which no longer existed. This was in November. The war had been over for 5 months, but it was only 2 weeks since this village had been demolished. In rubble were not only all of its houses and shops, but the new school and clinic were still under construction by the mission. When we arrived at the temporary quarters, we found two young women teaching two roomfuls of shivering children. Teachers and students greeted us politely and went on with their lessons. In a back room, a young man was unpacking boxes of medicine and arranging it in a small cabinet. "This is the clinic," he said. Everything had to start over. Why was the village blown up? I wanted to know. My guide said, "Terrorists were discovered somewhere near here, so they say, so everything had to go." I sat in a cold room late one winter afternoon and drank coffee with two Arabs whom I shall call Mahmoud and Abdul. And they told me the story of the refugees. Over a million Arabs left their homes in 1948 to go to any country that would receive them. Jordan alone got 645,000 of them. I recalled here how Sir Ronald Storrs had wondered how he was ever to cope with 5,000 refugees who gave an infinity of trouble. He noted of them, quote, as of some of the Jews in Palestine, that a people can be at once bitterly wronged and yet withal so maddeningly tiresome as sometimes to annihilate surprise, though never regret, for their sufferings, end quote. What was the effect of this influx of Arabs into less advanced countries? They took the bread and butter, as it were, out of the mouths of Jordanians. Anyone who was a porter, a bootblack, a carpenter, could do it better than a Bedouin. So the Bedouin found himself out of work. In 1950, the UNRWA was founded with the object of providing work for the refugees. It failed. How could Jordan, as a host country, support 645,000 newcomers? Have you ever looked at the Judean hills? Mahmoud asked me. What can anyone do with the Judean hills? Stony, windswept, and waterless. I had got a good look at them when I went to see where the prophet Amos had lived. The Judean hills are nearly bare of vegetation. The United Nations organized their relief program on the basis of 10 American cents per day per person, 5 cents for food, 4 for education, 1 penny for medicine. The refugees were counted, and the figure of 645,000 was frozen. There would be no more refugees officially recognized. Every child born after February 1951 is registered for statistics, but not for assistance. Children have continued to be born, of course, 122,000 of them, but they receive no assistance whatsoever. It is encouraging to the rest of the world to hear that the problem is being taken care of. So long as the figures can be reduced in one way or another, it appears that the problem is being solved. Israel is politically interested in reducing these figures, Abdul said. Although the UN is a non-political organization, it is supported by political sources. The United States provides 70% of the total, Britain and France the rest. Naturally, these powers insisted on a reduction of the figures. Besides the arbitrary freezing of the original census figure, there is a second method of scaling it down. Anyone who earns 8 Jordanian pounds per month is automatically dropped from the list as self-supporting, regardless of the number of dependents he may have. Because it is quite impossible for an Arab to support a family on this amount, the result of this ruling was unemployment. How could a father take a job that would force his family to live on more meager rations than were provided by relief? They were accused of laziness, but in truth, they were afraid. Abdul continued, there they sit, stewing in their hatred, in tents and miserable shacks, sponging off the donor countries, refusing to lift a finger, even to do the jobs offered to them. I began to see that this sort of accusation, made by honest but uninformed people, had a valid rejoinder. What exactly did this 5 cents a day for food provide? I was told that each person receives 20 pounds of flour per month, 1 pound each of sugar, rice, and beans, 1/2 pound of oil or fat, and 1 cake of soap. In the winter, he receives, in addition, 1.5 liters of kerosene. Nothing else. No fruits, vegetables, meats, or eggs. Expectant mothers and tuberculosis patients are given a special supplement of 10 pounds of flour and extra sugar and oil. Children up to 15 years of age are selected by a doctor to receive 1 hot meal a day for 3 months only out of a given year. I went over these figures again, carefully, with Abdul and Mahmoud. Surely I must have misunderstood. People live on these rations? Yes, a whole generation has grown up on them. What then is one to think of the, quote, basic seven foods which supermarket advertising persuades us are indispensable to a normal adult? What of the, quote, minimum daily requirement of vitamins, iron, niacin that cereal boxes proclaim? Quite obviously, words like minimum and requirement have highly specialized meanings. I began to speculate on some side questions, such as, what is the minimum daily requirement of the average American for, say, television viewing time? What is his MDR of coffee, cigarettes, recreation, hot water, and air conditioning, not to mention living space and groceries? I did not know what to feel about the question of the refugee, whether to be merely pained by it, or outraged, or even embarrassed and insulted. To be given this information was rather like being handed a time bomb. Here, take this and do something with it. What could I do? But that's what the German citizens said too, Mahmoud told me. They did not like to think of what might be happening to their Jewish ex-neighbors who had been spirited away. What could they do about it anyway? It was not their concern. And besides, the stories could not be true. Propaganda. Pure propaganda. Best to keep it entirely away from that sort of thing. Leave it to the experts, Eichmann and company. How could anyone be sure of the facts? For every, quote, fact I collected one day, there was one on the other side the next day. UNRWA figures, according to the Jerusalem Post in an article entitled "The Truth About the Refugees," are false and misleading, and, quote, in reality, no major refugee problem exists. Instead, an exchange of population has taken place. Israel has absorbed more than twice this number of Jewish refugees from Arab countries who were expelled by force, end quote. Expelled by force, counter the Arabs. Quote, no Arab country expelled them until Zionism stirred up controversy. Zionism, in fact, compelled Jews to leave Arab countries, end quote. The whole business was far too delicate and painful, but I went on asking questions. I had heard that the tons of clothing donated for refugees had been misused. You could find it for sale in the markets and souks. Who sold it? Where did the money go? The clothing that comes in for them is, of course, Western style. The Arab refugees are, for the most part, peasants. What are they to do with a business suit or a cocktail dress, or even with a good cotton house dress or a spring coat? They sell it in order to buy what they can wear. Is it possible to accomplish anything at all with 1 cent per day for medical needs? It did not seem so to me, but I found that epidemics have been successfully prevented and tuberculosis has been kept to an unusually small number of cases, considering the diet and living conditions. Until 1955, each family was allowed one American Army type tent every other year. But tents were more expensive than houses, so huts were built. And it was not, however, a simple matter to get people to move into them. A house, to an Arab, signifies that he belongs to the land. Why should I, who belong to Jericho, establish myself here, was his attitude. When the tents gave out altogether and no more were forthcoming, the refugees gradually gave in and moved into the cramped little stone or stucco huts, 9 by 9 feet square. I visited in one of these huts. It was clean and tidy, with straw mats on the floor, a neat pile of mattresses in one corner, a wooden wardrobe with 2 cardboard suitcases on top, a glass-doored cupboard with a few dishes, a TWA calendar with picture of Monticello, and some plastic flowers in a vase. We walked around the village which housed 20,000 people. The streets were clean, and there were latrines in every block and a faucet with running water. Men sat in the shops and smoked, played backgammon, and drank coffee. Women stood in the doorways and watched us. Children played in the streets. Nobody had anything to do. There were shops, of course, small ones with necessities. There was a barber shop and a shop that sold plastic sandals. But the general impression given was that nobody really had anything to do. They were just waiting. There were schools in the camps, and I heard that some of them were very good ones. The buildings were modern and spacious, with playing fields beside them. Every refugee of school age is in elementary or preparatory school, provided he is on a ration card. Before he can register in any UNRWA school, he must have a ration card. If he hasn't, he is an NR, a non-registered refugee, of which there are thousands. Many middle-class families, for example, reluctant to appeal to charity in the beginning, when it seemed that the situation would surely be rectified within 2 or 3 years, did not register. Now, their children are not entitled to assistance of any kind. Refugees have been accused of failing to report deaths. This may be true, but if a family has several non-registered members who can receive no assistance, it is not hard to see why they might try to conceal the death of a member who had a ration card. I asked Mahmoud and Abdul about the help Israel was giving the refugees. They glanced at each other. Quote, a notice appeared in the newspaper. Israel donates 1,000 tons of apples to refugees. Yes, this was true, but the apples were rotten. The distribution men could smell them when the trucks came in, so they had the work of transporting them, unloading them, and throwing them away. Why does not someone say no? They are all international people. International people are afraid to say no. Count Bernadette was sent here by the UN to work out a solution to the refugee problem. He was killed. Did anyone say anything? I heard many strange things about UNRWA. For one thing, relief had been sold to buy arms. Was this true? I asked. That relief has ever been sold to buy arms is the biggest lie in the world, shouted Abdul. And only a Jew could support it. How could he be sure that this had not happened? How could it happen? Abdul responded. UNRWA is controlled. It is controlled by the refugees themselves in the first place. If they come for their monthly pound of sugar, will they go away with only half a pound? Do you think they do not know exactly what is their due? The supplies are controlled also by the international auditors who come each year from New York. All records must be complete and verifiable. Was it true, I wanted to know, that the Israelis had rifled UNRWA stores and safes during the war in June? It is true, they said. Stores, safes in which funds were kept, cars. Israel took them all, sometimes at gunpoint. One Arab demanded a receipt. A gun barrel was shoved into his face, and he was told, "That's all the receipt you're going to get." And so the ironies piled up. The Arabs who belonged to the land and loved it, only as peasants can love it, were driven from it. And Israel pleads now for immigrants to fill their places. Israel, to prove that the land belongs to him who makes the most out of it, introduced modern agricultural methods and in certain places has made the, quote, desert blossom. Many of the show places of Israel, the Galilee and the plain of Sharon, for example, were fertile to begin with. They had been cultivated for centuries by Arabs before Israel brought in tractors. Palestine's most productive areas are now part of Israel. The irrigation projects, the miles of rich plowed land, set into sharp relief the dry Judean hills and the terraced slopes where the Arab follows his donkey with a wooden plow. Tourists cannot help see the difference. This is what Israel has done, they are told. And there you see what the Arabs did. It is not pointed out that Jaffa had oranges grown by Arabs or that every olive tree and vineyard was originally Arab-owned. Israel has only redecorated what we Arabs built, I heard one woman remark bitterly. It would not be tactful to inquire whether the Israeli method has proved to be self-supporting, as one supposes the Arab method must have been for quite a long time. Could Israel accomplish what it has done without millions of gift dollars? Could it have made a profit from the land? Nor does it do much good to ask whether people ought to be free to do what they choose with their own land. Are they allowed to use a wooden plow in this century? May a man wear sandals if the rest of the world wears shoes? If those who wear shoes feel guilty seeing a man in sandals, there is no remedy but that all put on shoes or plant cabbages and oranges instead of grapes and olives. Poverty, to the achievement-oriented, sometimes seems like a high price, but it is often the price of contentment. Other nations may offer sympathy and surplus food and cast-off clothing, but I have come to the opinion that it remains for Israel alone to execute justice for those who are its responsibility. If its highways must cut through the Arab's desert, if it claims eminent domain, it must justly compensate those who have been displaced, those whose empty houses and lands Israel is now determined to fill with its own immigrants. Quite apart from whether or not the people of modern Israel can lay claim to the title of chosen, or whether the land promised to the ancient Israelites justly belongs to them, it is hard to see how redemption can be spoken of at all without full regard for righteousness and justice. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly execute justice one with another, if you do not oppress the alien, the fatherless or the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own hurt, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave of old to your fathers forever.